Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 15th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Flashers, POCUS for Retinal Detachments, and our guest skeptic is Dr. Daniel Theodoro. He's an assistant professor of emergency medicine at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, and the Emergency Medicine Point of Care Ultrasound Section Chief. Welcome to the SGEM, Daniel.
Thanks, Ken. It is a total pleasure to be on the SGEM today.
Well, you have been a POCUS provider since the early days, back when it was just called ultrasound.
That's right. And I'm currently the ASEP Emergency Ultrasound Section Chair, which makes me feel really, really old. But one thing for sure is I am the eternal wisher that all ultrasound research could be deemed worthy of high praise, especially from the SGEM.
Well, we want to avoid too much of that sound, so why don't you give us a case?
All right. Well, today's case is an eye case. A 54-year-old diabetic female presents to your emergency department complaining of floaters and flashing lights, as well as some blurry vision. She has no pain. There's no history of trauma. She noticed that she couldn't read her daily political newspaper, like there was a wall of light between her left eye and the words on the sheet. She presents to you for answers. The vision in her right eye is about 20/40, and the vision in the left eye is 20/50. Left eye field of vision is significant for floaters that she tells you she sees, and a decreased capacity to see medially. She has no afferent pupillary defect or APD, and she has no obvious cranial nerve deficits. Her eye is not red, and her cornea is not hazy. The rest of her exam, it's normal.
Well, ocular complaints account for about 3 to 4% of all ED visits, but the cause for the vast majority of these are benign. 1 in 5 patients with eye complaints, however, will require an ED workup and referral for vision preservation. This group of pathology includes diagnoses such as uveitis, macular degeneration, occipital lobe disorders, and lastly, posterior chamber pathology, such as vitreous hemorrhage, vitreous and retinal detachments.
And retinal detachment is really important because in some cases, there's an intervention that will prevent and possibly even restore vision. And really, since preservation of vision and quality of life are so closely related, cases of retinal detachment deserve proper follow-up and referral to a retina specialist.
Well, traditionally, chamber pathologies are diagnosed with direct and indirect ophthalmoscopy. However, few doctors other than ophthalmologists are sufficiently expert enough to do this. And in the majority of ocular cases in the ED, the examination is skipped entirely.
This was super revealing to me, especially when I read the photo ED study. This was a study that revealed that ER docs only did fundoscopy in 14% of appropriate cases. Then what they did is they were able to take a picture of the retina in the back and send it for examination by a retina specialist within 24 hours. They enrolled 350 patients, and it turns out that the EPs only examined 33 of those patients whose findings were unknown and in whom fundoscopy may have had a role. In all 33, we missed the diagnosis. Granted that sometimes the diagnosis were things that you really wouldn't care too much about, like retina. Retinopathy or optic nerve pallor, not really acute emergencies, but still in one-third of the cases in this little observational study, it just showed that ED docs missed all of the important findings, really making the case that EPs just haven't developed or maintained fundoscopic skills.
Well, it's hard to find it if you don't look. It's more of a thing of omission than commission. Further complicating matters is that one study in California demonstrated that fewer than 50% of rural EDs, so that strikes home with me, and 75% of urban EDs have ophthalmology coverage. And this was California, a populous, wealthy U.S. state with a top 10 economy in the entire world. Knowing this, there are some tele-ophthalmology services going up online. they require a photograph to be taken of the fundus by a practitioner that is remotely viewed. These are known as 45-degree non-midriatic ocular fundus photographs. And one such company is known as Topcon.
Well, I don't think Topcon is the end-all be-all of all things. And then to make matters even worse, it turns out that direct ophthalmoscopy has poor test characteristics. And even indirect ophthalmoscopy, that's the one where the eye doctor is holding the lens in front of their face and reflecting light to see in the back of the patient, even that has limits until it's in the hands of these experienced and skilled ophthalmologists that tend to be retina specialists. In the hands of these experienced operators, indirect ophthalmoscopy has a positive likelihood ratio of 44, but a negative likelihood ratio of 0.23. And remember that the lower that likelihood ratio is, the closer it is to 0.01 to rule out a condition, the better. So even in their hands, they might miss a few things.
Well, this makes sense, though, because if you are repeatedly performing a skill over and over again correctly and receiving feedback and working to improve the skill you're working on, you're doing deliberate practice, as described by Eric Erickson. The key to becoming an expert, as he talks about. Most emergency physicians don't get regular feedback when using an ophthalmoscope. I know I don't. So one has to ask, is there an easier way, Daniel?
And of course, the answer is yes. Physicians began to use ocular ultrasound for the diagnosis of posterior chamber and some anterior chamber pathologies as well back in the 1950s. And surprise, surprise, it's been about 17 years since the idea first entered the emergency medicine academic literature. That number 17 just seems to always pop up.
Where'd you pull that one out of?
I don't know. I hear this guy named Chris Carpenter talking to me over in the top of my head.
Oh, and that's one person you do not want to have inside your head.
Nope. Well, anyway, the benefits to ocular ultrasound are that ultrasound devices are becoming more widespread in EDs across North America, and they're portable, so they can be taken right up to the patient at the bedside. And that's important because it means that you don't have to send the patient away to eye clinic or have them go to an ophthalmology office to get tested. And some would say that it's a little easier to perform the test than direct or indirect ophthalmoscopy.
Well, following the literature, it does seem that any diagnostic question, the answer is usually ultrasound, and any therapeutic question, the answer is ketamine these days.
I have no problems with ketamine, so I won't say anything to that.
Well, the reasons why are that visual information is magnified when you do this type of test with an ultrasound on a relatively big screen, and many physicians may be able to look at the data at once, and the exam is easily repeated. This allows for repetition with immediate feedback.
The cons are that it still remains a skill that we have to learn, albeit theoretically a little more learnable skill than looking through those tiny holes and flashing lights in people's eyes. And in 2015, there was a systematic review by Dr. Vrablic out of the University of Indiana. And he found these three studies, quoting, really high sensitivity and specificity for the diagnosis of retinal detachment using ocular ultrasound. Since that review was published in 2015, several larger trials have been reported in the literature, and some of them are worth talking about.
Well, let's get to a clinical question then, Daniel.
All right, great. Today's clinical question is, what are the testing characteristics of ocular point-of-care ultrasound when attempting to diagnose retinal detachment among a group of patients presenting with vision complaints?
And what's the reference?
The reference is Gottlieb, Holliday, and Pesca, point-of-care ocular ultrasound for the diagnosis of retinal detachment, a systematic review and meta-analysis, published in Academic Emergency Medicine in January 2019.
All right, let's run through the PICO. What population did they include?
They used patients enrolled in either a prospective or random controlled trial of patients presenting to the ED, radiology departments, and other such sites as ophthalmology clinics, being assessed for retinal detachment.
And so in their search, they excluded case reports, case series, retrospective studies, cadaver studies, and conference abstracts. What was the intervention?
The intervention was point-of-care ultrasound performed by operators with backgrounds in emergency medicine and radiology, but they all had varying experience levels, meaning in some cases it was all residents, in some cases it was all attendings, and in some cases it was people who had just been taught how to do ultrasound. There wasn't a mention of a defined protocol other than the use of a portable ultrasound machine being brought in to examine eyes.
And what did they compare it to?
Well, the comparison in any diagnostic test is usually the gold or reference test. And in this case, the gold standard reference test had to include a confirmatory test defined as a formal ophthalmologic exam, surgical findings if the patient went to surgery, CT findings, MRI findings, or that good old clinical follow-up.
Oh, I think we'll talk about that a bit more. How about their outcome? What was their primary outcome for this study?
The primary outcome was diagnostic accuracy of POCUS, meaning the sensitivity, specificity, and positive-negative likelihood ratio. And they also mentioned a bit about the positive and negative predictive value of the study.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, point-of-care ocular ultrasound is sensitive and specific for the diagnosis of retinal detachment. Future studies should determine the ideal training protocol and the influence of color Doppler and contrast-enhanced ultrasound on diagnostic accuracy, end of quote. All right, let's run through the 6 quality checklist questions for systematic reviews of diagnostic studies, Daniel. The first question, the diagnostic question is clinically relevant with an established criterion standard.
Yes, I think it is.
The search for studies was detailed and exhaustive.
Yes, I think the authors did a fine job with this.
The methodological quality of the primary studies was assessed for common forms of diagnostic research bias.
Yes, they were.
The assessment of studies was reproducible.
Yes, it was.
There was low heterogeneity for estimates of sensitivity or specificity.
I would say no in this case.
All right, and the final 6th question. The summary diagnostic accuracy is sufficiently precise to improve upon existing clinical decision-making models.
I would say no in this case, too.
All right, let's go through the key results for this systematic review. Investigators found close to 3,000 articles in their lit search, and 11 studies made the cut for inclusion in the meta-analysis. The 11 studies were all observational studies, with a total of 844 patients. Emergency medicine clinicians performed the POCUS exam in 6 of the studies. What was the big key result?
The overall diagnostic parameters of POCUS to diagnose retinal detachment was very good.
Let's dig into that just a little bit. How about the overall diagnostic accuracy?
The sensitivity and specificity were 94.2% and 96.3%, with a likelihood ratio positive of 23.5 and likelihood ratio negative of 0.06.
Now that was all comers. How about ED providers? How good were we?
Well, we had a sensitivity of 92% and a specificity of 91.4%. That would translate into a likelihood ratio positive of 10 and a negative likelihood ratio of 0.09.
Well, I'll put a table in the show notes that goes through the sensitivity, specificity, and the likelihood ratios for everyone to read. But let's talk a little bit about the area under the receiver operator characteristic curve. It demonstrated high accuracy, 0.988, while the heterogeneity was moderate, with an I squared of 0.59. The funnel plot did not show evidence of publication bias. Well, those were the key results. Daniel, it's time to talk nerdy. And I've got the first one, and this is about the methods. They did an excellent job with their methods. They followed the PRISMA DTA guidelines and registered their review. The search was exhaustive, and that's because they used the talents of a medical librarian. I love medical librarians. And this found 4 studies that were not discussed in the prior systematic review and added another 4 studies of pretty high quality.
The confidence intervals. Well, the 95% confidence intervals around the point estimates were really wide. This makes us a little less confident in the results. Some of the range in the confidence interval could have been due to heterogeneity.
Well, that leads to point number 3 about heterogeneity. And when you put different studies together into a systematic review, there will be variability across studies. The variability can be clinical, methodological, or both. Clinical variability can be due to the participants in the study, the interventions, and outcomes studied. Methodological variability can be due to study design and risk of bias. The variability in studies is quantified using the I2 statistic. And statistical heterogeneity, then, is the amount of difference in effect between studies greater than the expected by chance or randomness alone. And like I said previously, this study had an I-squared of 0.59, suggesting that there was moderate heterogeneity between the studies meta-analyzed.
And this heterogeneity observed between the studies could have been due to a number of different biases. And that's something that I love to talk about in not just this ultrasound study, but all ultrasound studies. Because biases are something that systematically move us away from the truth. One such bias is something called partial verification bias. This isn't mentioned in the papers, but in studies with lower specificities and higher sensitivities than the pooled estimate, it makes one wonder if it took place. So how does this occur? This is the old-fashioned problem when only some people get a true gold standard, like formal eye exam or CT or MRI or referral to the ophthalmologist, which is what a lot of these papers in this meta-analysis would do. And the problem happens when only the ones that do get referral or a follow-up are the ones that have a particular result on the ocular POCUS exam. In other words, the protocol is not strictly enforced on all patients with visual complaints.
All right, well, let's just put on our imagination hats here, okay? So, Daniel, putting on your imagination hat, do you have it on?
It's on.
Okay, I've got my imagination hat on. Imagine this scenario, if you will. If the ocular POCUS has an obvious finding, ophthalmology will likely see the patient and the patient will enter in the study. Now imagine the opposite. Imagine cases where the ocular POCUS is negative, the patient's complaints are relatively minor, and the patient has a non-ophthalmologic follow-up. The gold standard is not applied based on not only the negative ultrasound, but the intensity of the complaints. And many of the studies used convenient sampling, meaning tests were only done if all the pieces were in place, and this encourages partial verification bias.
Statistically, when this happens, the true negatives, that's your D-box in that 2x2 organization that we always examine the diagnostic properties of a test in. When that D-box goes down and the C-box go down, statistically, an interesting thing happens. The false negatives are actually increased in greater proportion than the true negatives. And the mathematical effect of all of this is that you have increases in sensitivity and decreases in specificity.
Okay, listen, they told me there'd be no math, so no more talk about mathematics. Let's just keep this philosophical. So let's talk about differential verification bias, because I don't need math for that, okay? So in real estate, you know, Daniel, it's all location, location, location. A double gold standard bias, it's timing, timing, timing. And this is when different follow-ups apply to different patients. Hence the double gold standard. And this is important. The disease can change according to what type of follow-up the patient ultimately receives. Here's the scenario. Positive POCUS exam with large obvious retinal detachment. Boom. Referred to that specialist within 6 hours. Minor findings get follow-up 72 hours later. Is 6 hour follow-up different from 72 hour follow-up?
I would say it would be. There's another scenario you can also take into account. Say your POCUS is negative for detachment, but it does note something called the vitreous bleed. We know that sometimes vitreous bleeds are the first sort of step in the pathologic process to a retinal detachment. But fine, it's a vitreous bleed. These guys get follow-up in 72 hours as opposed to 6 hours. If it was really a mild tear missed by POCUS and it became worse in those 72 hours, then POCUS looks really bad because it said, oh, this was a little tear and that turned out to be a false negative. And this results into a fall in sensitivity and specificity. Conversely, if the mild tear would readhere in 72 hours, and I'm not an ophthalmologist, but I've been told that some people do re-adhere the retina. So if this happens and the patient goes for follow-up and goes, hey, I don't have any vision problems right now, well, then the POCUS looks way better than stated.
So how do you take this? You have to dive into the studies that varied from the pooled estimate and see what they actually did. Sure enough, in some, there was a 1 to 6 week follow-up, and in the others, there was an immediate follow-up, CT or some other confirmatory test. A lot can happen in 6 weeks, so readers have to be aware that this can happen and explain some of the heterogeneity when the studies are way off the pooled estimate.
Another example of heterogeneity is spectrum bias. And this is the classic when you do a study, a diagnostic study, but you only do it in the sickest of the sick. How about mild vision complaints? All diagnostic vision tests look great if you include only intense vision loss, or if you exclude, say, those patients with vitreous detachments because they're similar. You just don't put them in the analysis of your final diagnostic outcome.
One can loosely judge this by prevalence and convenient sampling. The prevalence of disease in some of these studies was near 50%, but we know the vast majority of eye complaints are benign. So what's happening here? I don't think everyone who presents with blurry vision is being considered for inclusions in these studies.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's also cases where there's potential stroke or other neurodisease mimics that turn out to be posterior chamber pathologies. We just don't know if these people are also included in any of these studies. And this is an area one could pick up for future studies, say in a large multi-centered trial with hard clinical endpoints and pre-scheduled, predefined follow-ups.
Only one of the included studies followed the STARD criteria, and that's the Standards for Reporting of Diagnostic Accuracy Studies. The objectives of the STAR initiative is to, quote, improve the completeness and transparency of reporting of studies of diagnostic accuracy to allow readers to assess the potential for bias in the study's internal validity and to evaluate its generalizability, external validity, end of quote. The lack of adherence to the STARD criteria suggests that the included studies were of lower quality. Seeing as the prevalence of disease seems to be high in all of the studies, the reader can assume that this could have introduced some bias.
The fourth thing we want to talk about is the evaluation of the index test. In this case, ocular POCUS, as it pertains to training, as well as the training issues surrounding the criterion or gold standard. What do I mean by this? Well, some of the studies had really experienced, really interested people who probably spent a lot of time learning how to do ocular ultrasound on YouTube, reading papers, knowing how to avoid pitfalls, and reviewing their knowledge or something of that nature doing the studies. In other cases, the index test users, the people doing the ultrasound, got a 20-minute course and then they were set free. The study did try to address this with a series of post hoc analyses, though.
Likewise, some patients receive follow-up by a retinal specialist who would have a
ton.
Now, we're not going to talk about metric tons versus other tons of training, while others were followed up by ophthalmology residents with less experience. In yet other cases, highly trained POCUS providers were followed up by less trained ophthalmologists. You can see how this might set up an imperfect situation.
And when this happens, the biases can really go every which way if you sit down and think about it. So, for example, say you have an ophthalmoscopic trainee, an eye doctor who's in residency, and they've been looking at eyes for, oh, say about 18 months. I bet you they tend to nail the true negatives, but miss some mild tears, you know, the really mild positive retinal detachment. I bet you they miss that. So that means that they would miss the true positives. Well, if the ocular POCUS provider is really good, you know, been going to YouTube and sharpening up their POCUS skills, and they end up correctly classifying the retinal detachment, but the trainee who's 18 months out of medical school misses it, well, then the number of supposed miscategorized false positive studies increases, decreasing specificity. These relationships can go in many different ways, and worse, they can arise on a case-by-case basis or at what we would call in the research language, the patient level. And this is a source of heterogeneity. The combinations of these are endless. They can go every which way. And readers should just be aware of this possible source of bias and decide if it's a real apples-to-apples comparison when the studies are included in these meta-analyses.
And I'm just going to remind Daniel that this is an audio podcast, so we don't actually have to mime out the air quotes. The fifth and final point we wanted to talk about was Mac on or Mac off. The risk of missing a retinal detachment depends on the status of the macula in relationship to the detachment. If the retinal detachment has taken the macula off, then there's really not much to offer the patient. This is a macular off tear, meaning the macula has been torn off. If the tear abuts but does not involve the macula, then the macula is still on. And this is a true emergency, because the patient can undergo interventions to tether the remaining retina and preserve vision. That ends all the nerdiness there, Daniel. Let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
Okay, well, we agree with the authors that ocular pocus is sufficiently specific to diagnose retinal detachments. But we disagree that the sensitivity is sufficiently high enough to rule out the diagnosis in cases that present with floaters and vision changes. But in general, we agree this has to do more with training than the actual limitations of the ultrasound technology, and that we do have to lobby our training programs to spend more time teaching how to do the procedure to instill a high level of performance and confidence in our trainees and future emergency room doctors.
All right, give us an SGEM bottom line.
Well, early on in your POCUS training, if you identify a retinal detachment, make the call. But be careful if you don't see any pathology and make sure that the patient has immediate consultation or, at a minimum, immediate follow-up. As you get better and better as you progress in your POCUS training, you may become more confident with cases so that you can use the technology and do more rule outs.
And how about a case resolution?
Sure. So in this case, you make the diagnosis of a retinal detachment, but you're concerned that the macula remains intact because the tear does not reach the optic nerve. You consult ophthalmology, who schedules the patient for a procedure in order to preserve vision.
And how are you going to take this information and apply it clinically then?
Well, ocular pocus is highly specific, meaning it's great if the pathology is readily visible. But we need to do more research and determine if its unacceptable sensitivity right now is due to the lack of training or the limitations of the technology itself.
So what are you going to do when you're sitting at the patient's bedside? What are you going to tell them?
Well, unfortunately, Ken, in the United States, the first question that we ask is, hey, what kind of insurance do you have? But putting that aside for now, I'd explain it like this. Look, your retina is like a movie screen. You know, you go to the movies, you sit down, you look up, and you see a wonderful film. Well, imagine if that movie screen started pulling away from the theater back wall. You might be able to see, say, 3/4 of the movie, but in that area where the movie screen had been pulled off, it'd be blurry, it'd be off. That's what a retinal detachment really is. Now, if that screen would be totally pulled off and I can easily see it, I'm going to give the eye doctor a call right now. But if everything looks pretty good and you can see the movie, I'll say, hey, what's your follow-up? Can you get seen by an eye doctor in the next, say, 24 hours? And if you have a good relationship with your eye doctor, I might say, okay, get out of here. Just make sure that you can be seen. But if on the other hand, they say, oh, I don't even have an eye doctor, in those cases, I admit, I'll call my consultant and try to get them really fast, expedient follow-up in the emergency department.
And what do you tell them if you do discharge them home? Do you give them any warning about their vision and what happens to do or when to follow up?
Oh, absolutely. I prefer that most cases get follow-up in, say, 24, maybe 72 hours is pushing it. And I tell them if anything changes, if you wake up tomorrow and you can't see, say, over half your eye, you need to come back immediately, because it's possible that whatever we saw was just the beginning of the case, and overnight, things get worse.
All right, it's time for the Keener Contest, and last week's winner was Brandon Snyder, a first-year medical student from Ohio University Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine. He knew the dose of magnesium for treating eclampsia is 4 to 6 grams via 500 mils IV normal saline. Daniel, what question do you have for us this week?
Well, this is a tough one that even I had to look up, I admit it. But the question is, what are the three types of retinal detachments?
Well, if you know the three types of retinal detachments, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize.
There are several Foam Ed platforms with videos on how to perform an eye exam. The authors in this paper include one that's really worth reviewing, and you can find that and download it for free online. ASET members can download a free iBook from the Apple Store that also teaches these techniques.
Well, thank you, Daniel, for coming on the SGEM to discuss POCUS for retinal detachments.
It was a real pleasure to be skeptical with the Skeptic's Guide.
Well, can you read the Skeptic's Guide tagline then?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.